Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Rurink, and our special guests from Grassroots Midwest, Adrian Hemond and Brian Beegan. Thanks for joining us, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Yep.
All right, so John, the big news from Friday and now carrying over to Monday is the state Senate or the U.S. Senate race. Fred Upton has decided he is not going to run, and instead we're going to see more Sandy Pensler, it looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. We had a little bit of a shakeup. I think Upton realized that he's probably not quite as in step with the Republican Party as he may have been 10 or 20 years ago. I think he's probably a little bit too moderate for a U.S. Senate primary race. Might have done well in the general, but I think he probably looked at it and realized he might not get to that general. So Pensler's coming in, going to apparently self-fund his campaign. I'm not sure what that does to the mix of the race. I kind of think it's going to become a personality contest, and I think right now, if I were to hazard a guess, I'd give John James a little bit of the edge in that race.
Well, we're going to talk with Sandy Pensler. As it turned out, I had some audio that I was saving just for such an occasion. I was able to speak with Sandy Pensler during the Mackinac Policy Conference a couple months ago, and we'll play back that audio. But let's talk to our guests. Adrian, what did you make of that? Fred Upton out, Pensler in. Does that help Republicans?
You know, potentially. I mean, Sandy Pensler is the sort of candidate that can self-fund. As you say, he said he's going to do as much. And that's very important if you're going to try and take out a pretty solid incumbent in Debbie Stabenow. Obviously, he's got a primary that he's got to contend with first. But if he can come out of that primary and he's willing to dump several million dollars of his own money into a general election, he could make that competitive depending on the environment.
When I saw Fred Upton get out, and that kind of said to me that D.C. is not necessarily interested in Michigan. Did you kind of read the same thing?
I don't know if it was about that. I just figured with Fred is like, at this point in his career, it's like, yeah, why bother? It's just like, he's like, hey, I'm comfortable. I've been here for like 20-some years. I can stay here as long as I want. And it doesn't look like it'll be a cakewalk. So I'm cool.
Well, and it wouldn't have been a cakewalk. I mean, our last poll, John, showed that he was behind John James. And so if he couldn't get out of a primary, then what's the point of facing Debbie Stabenow in a general election? And you take a look at what's going on nationally, guys. I don't know what you think on this, but the Republicans got problems elsewhere in this country. And taking a shot at a three-term incumbent may not be the highest thing on the priority list.
I think that's right. I mean, the Republicans are playing defense at the national level in the Senate and the House right now. And, you know, pursuing pickup opportunities against three-term incumbents is not great strategy when they've got seats that they need to fill. The Jeff Flake retirement in Arizona is a good example of that. There's the possibility that Roy Moore could lose that Senate race in Alabama. I'm a little skeptical, but you know, keep a happy thought about that. But there's, you know, they've got seats that they need to fill in order to protect their majority in the Senate. And if you're Mitch McConnell and, you know, the National Senate Republicans, that really has to be your first job.
You take a look at, let's say, Indiana, Missouri. These are better opportunities. West Virginia, those are better opportunities than Michigan, which Trump won by the skin of his teeth.
Right. I mean, the only exception, I think, to that is if John James, if he catches on fire and got enough national attention, could actually make this a little bit more of a competitive race than we think it's going to be right now.
But if he's able to catch fire.
That's a big if.
Oh,
I mean, he's got the story. Obviously, we've all talked about that. He's got the background. He's got the look. He's got the whole thing. But the question is, can he catch fire and can he bring in enough resources on his own charm to really make this competitive?
Brian, what are odds you put on the Republicans doing something and knocking off Debbie Stabenow? 10%? 5%?
Well, any man with two hands has a fighting chance. So I'm going to go and say probably about 30% chance knock her off.
Is that over-optimistic, Adrian?
I think it's a little over-optimistic. I'd give him one chance in six right about now.
One chance in six. Okay, I'm going to have to do the math on that. What is that, John? 17%?
16%?
16%? Okay, something like that.
I think I would go with 30 to 40%.
Would you? I think I'm more on the Adrian side.
Just, politics are so hard to predict right now. I mean, how many times have we been wrong in the last year?
Exactly, right?
Right?
So yeah, I guess we should.
Makes me hesitant to rule anybody out.
Well, let's move on to something a little more homegrown. We'll talk about the state Senate race. Adrian and Brian, this is your expertise in the Senate and the state House. Let's start in the state Senate. Where are we focusing on here? The Republicans have pretty much the high water mark right now with their 27-11 split right now. What's the best the Dems can hope for?
You know, I think that if you're Curtis Hertel, Dave Kinesic, and Jim Ananick, and you're looking at the Senate field right now, if you pick up 3 seats this election cycle, I think that's a great year. Just based on what the fields look like so far, obviously there's stuff that can develop there, and what seats they currently hold, it's really hard to see them getting above a 3-seat pickup, and I think you'd be really happy with that if you're the Senate Democrats right now.
The best chance of a pickup, where would you put it? Would you put it in the Sal Rocca seat, or is there somewhere else? The Hansen seat, Winnie Brinks, where are you going?
I like the Rocca pickup opportunity, probably the best of anything that I've got on my list right now. They've got a stud candidate in Henry Yanez, who's won some competitive races in the past in that geography, has butted heads with his own caucus sometimes and maybe hasn't had all the support that a candidate would like. But he's been able to pull through every time. The Republican side, it remains to be seen who comes out of that. You've got Leon Drolet, who's very likely to run for that seat. You've got Michael Shalal, who's already running for that seat and just barely lost a primary to Diana Farrington last cycle. I like that opportunity a lot.
Brian, where do you think the Republicans are most vulnerable?
Probably still a continuation of like some of the more suburb areas too, as we're going back from the whole Trump experience from 2 years ago, because I don't know if his numbers in Oakland County ever really rebounded. So you're going to see that probably in like the 7th district where Pat Kolbach is going out, and maybe even some of these other ones out that way, where you're going to have some of these more suburban lean areas that kind of thin on terms of base percentage, but that could be a chance to be surprised.
Maybe like a Marty Nolenberg. He's an incumbent, but yeah. Still, I mean, that's not Trump country necessarily.
No, it's not, where Trump maybe just barely like survived some of these places or just got it because, okay, yeah, Trump did big numbers outstate. And when you look at just how Trump was doing in those races compared to where Bush was, it's like, wow, he's going to like win big. But then you get to where he like just tanks like in the 40th House District. He underperformed greatly in the 41st, 39th. And I don't think Donald Trump's done anything to get these people back.
As you're taking a look at this map, it looks like we've got some real competitive races already forming in, let's say, the 38th District. Scott DeAnda, Ed McBroom, there's another candidate there as well, Winnie Brinks and Chris Afendoulis. We got some real showdowns shaping up here, don't we, Adrian?
Yeah, I think that's right. The race to replace Dave Hildenbrand, I think, will be hot between Brinks and Afendoulis. You know, that UP race is really interesting between DeAnda and McBroom. You've got the race to replace Rick Jones. You've got a competitive Republican primary there between Brett Roberts and Tom Barrett. And the winner of that gets to face off against Kelly Rossman McKinney, which is about as good a candidate as the Dems have recruited in that seat in a long, long time. And the base numbers are pretty good for Democrats there. So I think those are all likely to be competitive. There's a potential that the 34th to replace Jeff Hansen could be competitive as well. You've got a competitive Republican primary between Holly Hughes and John Bumstead. And the county clerk in Muskegon is in for the Democrats. She's a little older, but has got some personal wealth she can bring to bear.
Waters, right?
Waters, that's right. And I think there are, Brian brought up the Kolbach seat. I think that's another interesting one to keep an eye on. You know, my sort of dark horse here is the 31st, the Mike Green seat.
And tell me about the Democratic candidate there, Lusick, right? She's another county clerk.
She is the county clerk in Bay County. Her family also owns the big Catholic funeral home in Bay City. She's pro-life, pro-gun, the sort of profile that you want from a Dem candidate in an area like that Senate district. And you've got a competitive Republican primary on the other side where the candidates could very well bloody each other up pretty good between Gary Glenn and Kevin Daley. So I think that's more of a dark horse. I think the Republicans are pretty heavily favored there. But that's one that the Dems could potentially pull out. They seem like they have the right sort of candidate.
Brian, the odds that the Democrats are able to get even to a 19-19 split, what kind of chance would you give it? 5%, 10%?
Probably say about 10% at best.
Adrian?
I'm the Democrat, and I think that's over-optimistic.
Really? Okay.
I would say it's a non-zero chance, but that's as far as I'm willing to go.
Is it almost like rolling a six on a dice 7 times in a row?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good analogy.
All right, well, let's move on to the House, guys. 63-47 split right now. Republicans looking pretty good. And what makes things even better for them is there doesn't seem to be a lot of open seats where Republicans are leaving, with the exception of maybe Bison. But for every John Bison, it seems like there's a Democrat competitive leaving, like a Henry Yanez or Scott DeAnda.
I think a lot of this depends on what Brian alluded to earlier. How is Trump going to play in a lot of these seats? There are opportunities there in some open seats for Democrats. It's places that have been further down the list for them. You brought up Bison, and I think that's the right place to start. But you look at those Oakland County seats, 40, the McCready seat, 39, the Kesto seat, 41, the Hauerlach seat. These are places that Trump did very badly. The 41st in particular is a place where Democrats have been competitive, including with some under-resourced candidates in the past. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's a real good pickup opportunity for them. Those three Oakland County seats, the road to the majority runs through there for the Democrats. They have to have all three of those if they're going to flip the House. That's tough, but I think it's very doable. You've obviously got Tom Barrett leaving in the 71st to run for that state Senate seat. So that's another one where the Democrats could try to pick up. The Republicans have a real strong candidate there, but that's another competitive one where a Republican's leaving. After that, it starts to get a little thinner in terms of Republicans that are leaving, and you would probably have to take some incumbents out, because to your point, there are some Democrats in competitive or potentially competitive seats that are also leaving, like a Winnie Brinks or a Tom Cochran.
Or Holly Hughes. I mean, that's a district that she's been able to self-finance for many years, Brian. Yeah. Without Holly Hughes there, could the Democrats finally get that seat? I guess they've gotten it with Valentine before, right?
Well, yeah, the same thing with Lamonti. But yeah, but after 10 years, you're not going to have like Holly Hughes on the ballot anymore. So,
right.
And I saw Jerry Van Workum's son is the candidate running, so he should be pretty well in good position to raise money and get going. It's just that, do the Dems really have anyone, or can they just kind of coast on like the year and be able to get through? Because one can make the assumption too that Mary Valentine may not have been the preferred candidate, but yet won, considering the circumstances.
Right.
So,
and we've seen that in many districts before, haven't we, guys, where the Democrats have put up somebody who on paper doesn't seem all that strong, and yet because of the wave year or whatever, they become a state representative.
That's right. I think
Deb Kennedy. I mean, you can go on both sides.
Yeah, I think that's right. Especially for Democrats. This is true for both parties, but especially for Democrats, we're so reliant on turnout and who actually shows up. And, you know, the higher turnout goes, the better things are going to tend to look for a Democrat in a general election. So the environment's going to be especially important this time around because of that, and because of the deep unpopularity of the president in a lot of areas. Who shows up in these seats? Can some place like Muskegon coast through for the Democrats? It's entirely possible. Are there a lot of motivated women and, you know, second and third generation immigrants in Oakland County that show up to vote this time? That could make a big difference for Democrats. So I think that's got to be a big focus for them if they want to be competitive, is ginning that turnout so that you can get a couple of those bonus seats where you just coast through and maybe don't have the candidate that you wanted.
Brian, I want to ask you about Macomb County, because Macomb County is what really gave Michigan to Donald Trump in 2016. And they also swept, really, these state House races. But we saw that with that, we also got a can of corn for their Macomb County clerk. Does that have an impact in these state House races? Or are Democrats, you think, wisely maybe not challenge like a Steve Marino or a Diane Farrington this time around?
I could definitely see them trying, just sheerly on the base numbers, because they need to get to 56, and that's part of how they're going to do it, is try and go after some of these incumbents. But from as my understanding is, Trump is still actually doing all right in Macomb, because Donald Trump is essentially a Macomb guy. So as long as he's there, he might be able to keep some of these folks up.
And maybe create a pickup opportunity in the 25th there that Henry Yanez is leaving. I mean, there are pickup opportunities here for Republicans.
Yeah, certainly there is that pickup opportunity. And at the same time, that could like block Henry in his bid for Senate, because the Trump voters pull him up. Now, I don't know if people have got quite the buyer's remorse in regards to the clerk that, you know, who's just so colorful. But again, I don't know if people are going to think about it that far ahead. They're just going to be like, all right, yep, we like what Trump's doing. We like his rhetoric. We like what he's saying. So we're just going to keep going the course.
What's your thoughts here on some of the incumbents? Bellino, Camilleri, either of these guys, Lefebvre, any of these guys we should be keeping an eye on?
You know, Darren Camilleri has worked really hard.
He has, hasn't he?
He worked hard to get himself in through his primary to win his general election. He was really the only Democrat that went and won one of those competitive open seats last time. I think he'll be fine. Bellino is an open question for me. The base numbers for Republicans in that district are bad, frankly. You know, Bellino seems like a pretty good candidate. I feel like Monroe County is a place where Trump is probably holding as steady as he is anywhere these days. I could see Bellino losing that, but it's going to be a tough row to hoe for Democrats. They're gonna need to recruit a quality candidate and go deep.
Lavoie,
I've heard rumors that he's going to run again.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, he would need to work harder than he did last time. I think even Bill realizes that he definitely did not leave it all on the field last time. But I think that's a good pickup opportunity for them. You know, if they can recruit somebody quality in 99, I think Roger Houck's another one that they could potentially take out, especially if, you know, they can gin turn out a little bit in the city of Mount Pleasant. Those two Macomb seats, I think Began was exactly right about. You have to recruit and run somebody quality there. You have to make Republicans spend money in those seats. Even if you don't really think you're going to win, you can't let the Republicans just take those off the board as protect opportunities. You know, the Vandewall seat, 101, I think is another one that you can look at. Democrats have held this a couple times in the recent past. You know, that one's been trending bluer and bluer every time with folks moving up there and retiring. You know, some of the hipster crowd coming up from Southeast Michigan to settle on the peninsula out there. That one keeps getting better and better for Dems, so I think that's another shot for them.
You know, when I take a look at this map, it seems like those areas that are opening up and would be a possibility for Democrats are also places that Trump did pretty well. And I'm taking a look at your list here. I'm reading upside down on you here, but I'm taking a look at Gary Glenn's seat, Joe Graves' seat. You would think, well, geez, maybe they'd have a possibility there, but those also seem like Trump areas.
Pretty much a lot of northern Michigan has gotten very Trump-like because it's just an older area, and I think they rely more sort of on the industries that Donald Trump is going to protect.
Right.
You know, you're going to be able to farm the way you want to farm. You're going to be able to own the gun you want to own. You're going to be able to go hunting. You're going to go, you know, do logging. All these things that you've done forever, you know, we're going to keep that. We're going to keep your communities great. And so they're just kind of struggling to hold on because you got, like, the smaller factories that are shutting down. And again, it's a much older conservative crowd, whereas, like, and I think that's kind of why when you're Oakland County, where you have a more professional class that are doing well, and they hear Trump talk about this, and they're like, whatever.
Right.
So it's just sort of kind of a cultural shift, and that's why Trump is, you know, speaking to this older, more conservative crowd that are just like, well, I remember when, too. So
much can change, John, in politics, and we know this. And maybe right now, if we were holding House elections today, I would think that Republicans would do okay. I mean, they might lose some seats, maybe 61, 62, maybe they end up with, maybe they even pick up one, who knows.
Yeah, but you know, it's like those economic forecasts where they get you to the end, they say everything looking really good, but by the way, here's all the things that could really screw everything up. And if you look at the national level, there's a lot of things that could get really screwed up depending on what happens with the president. Does he get in trouble? Does that upset anything? What happens to his support? Does it stay exactly the same? Does it, maybe tax reform goes through and maybe he goes up? I mean, there's so much that we don't know. It's going to be really hard to tell until this time next year.
I think that's exactly right. Partly because of holding the presidency, partly because of, you know, having been blown out for the last few cycles around the country in Michigan, the Democrats, most of the downside risk in this election cycle is with the Republicans, because they control a lot of things, because they've got, you know, a president who is polarizing, to say the least, and is deeply unpopular in some traditionally politically competitive areas. The downside risk is all on their side. That doesn't mean that the Democrats will be able to capitalize on all of that, or that, you know, all the negative things that could happen will come true for Republicans. But there are a lot of those downside risk factors that you get at the end of the forecast where things could go south for them really badly.
Any closing thoughts on this here, Brian?
It should be a wild ride. Again, it's like, okay, what kind of wave will we be looking at if things keep going the way they are? Because in 06, things seemed all right till the end, and then 08, you already knew, oh, okay, how are we going to save the ship?
Well, exactly. And it's interesting you mentioned 06 because I was thinking of 06 the other day when analyzing and preparing for this podcast, because the Republicans in 06 thought everything was just hunky-dory and fine. And then it got to be about September and it was like, holy cow, something could really happen here.
Oh, yeah. Pretty much by the end of October, it was like my assignments were like, oh, yeah, you need to go look at this race now, or we're going to start sending people over to like Livonia now. And it's like, that's when people first started got the hint that things were starting to go sideways. And it was like, all right, feeling good. We're going to keep majority. Within about a half hour, started seeing some results out of Jackson or whatever. And it's like, oh, crap.
Yeah,
but at least in 2008, we already knew we lost.
Yeah,
right. Election. I'll leave you with an anecdote. A couple weeks out from election night 06, I was enterprising young staffer with the Michigan House Democrats. We got called to our old offsite operation, and Diane Byram and Mark Fisk gave us this rah-rah speech in the basement of the offsite and told us that, you know, if we worked our tails off and we did everything right and had a little bit of luck break our way, we might be able to get to shared control on election night. And on election night, the big joke around the Democratic offsite was, who the hell is Mark Corvo? And I leave you with that thought, because the road to the majority for the Democrats is, it's going to take a surprise or two. In 06, it was Mark Corvo and Terry Brown, a Democrat who'd won that district for the first time since the Civil War. We weren't expecting either of those. We had pulled out Terry Brown's race, and not many people knew who Mark Corvo was. We pulled those two over the finish line, and that was our margin.
Amazing how things work out. That's what makes politics so much fun, isn't it, John?
Absolutely.
Yep. All right. Well, thank you very much, Ben and Adrian. Appreciate you guys coming in and giving us some insight from Grassroots Midwest.
Yeah.
And with that, John, we're going to go over and revisit our interview here with Sandy Pentler.
Now, somebody talked to me the other day. He said, is this the guy who ran for Congress in the 90s?
1992, which Tom reminded me.
What? You were a lot younger then.
Different lifetime.
Yeah, talk about that and compared to where you are now in your life.
I had done investment banking. I had not gone off on my own. I hadn't really... Investment bankers think they're risk takers, but they're part of big enterprises to take the risk. They don't really individually take a lot of risk. I went off on my own, started up my own company, bought some troubled companies, turned around the troubled companies. Still did a little advisory work and some more teaching, taught economics over at Yale a little more. But really, learning how to drive a company and run it rather than advise it. So purchasing companies that were failing and turning them is different than advising them.
Yeah.
So that's really the shift. And much smaller companies, because I owned them, where before I was just advising them.
So tell me where you are right now in your life and why you decided that this is something you might want to pursue.
I decided where I am in my life. I've got two wonderful kids. One's 19 at Brown University, the other's 13 going on 20. We were sitting around a table, and we have this tradition in our house. We always talk about different things, some that are issues of the day that are bothering us. And I always say to the kids, when they're done, what are you going to do about it? And I was actually griping about a policy, general Democratic policy, but a particular one of Ms. Stabenow's. And my daughter looked at me and she goes, okay, Dad, what are you going to do about it?
Is this the 13-year-old?
This is the 13-year-old. I don't have many regrets in life. And one of the things I think you have to do, and I try to inculcate in my kids, which is my biggest job, don't be a bystander. And so I was pushing them, I'm always pushing them, get involved, do something. And I thought, you know, I've been very fortunate. Economically, I'm really blessed. I'm blessed health still. And I'm troubled by the way the country's moving. There's this incredible split. One party that's both well-intentioned, there's no question, both patriots.
Mm-hmm.
But one party is moving in a direction of the collective and government directive from Washington, or government direction in Michigan's case from Lansing, and the other party espouses, not always follows, but espouses principles of individual choice, and whether that, it really covers the economy, market-driven solutions, education, choice, where you put tax dollars. And I'm pretty firmly in the camp that people aren't smart enough to direct from Washington and from Lansing. Individuals, when they work on issues, get into different details at such micro levels that when you try to direct from Washington with a one-size-fits-everything, you will screw it up. So not only are you not effective, you take away wonders that come from making all your own decisions. So hence I'm a Republican. And that's why now in life? You know, I'm lucky. I got some money. I got some freedom. I want to give something. The country's been wonderful to me.
So when you come to this conference then, and you see Bob Young's out running, and Fred Upton has got an event, looks like he's heading that direction.
We'll see.
Is that intimidating at all?
No. Look, it's a marketplace of ideas. And I think my experience, my background, my ideas will be better. And if they're not, so be it.
Does this mean you're going to take a step away from what you're doing in the private sector? Or?
Sure.
Okay.
A lot of time that I've spent in the last couple months is trying to make sure that the companies are well situated, that instead of spending 60 hours a week on the companies, if that drops down to 10, 2, or 2, they'll be just fine. But that's not easy. That took some time.
How many companies do you have?
There are 4 manufacturing companies, a warehousing company, an internet education company, a medical device company, and then some other investments. So, I don't know, what is that, 6 or 7?
6 or 7?
Yeah.
You own 6 or 7 companies?
Yeah.
So where do you live?
I primarily live in Grosse Pointe Park.
Okay.
Which, by the way, you ran around this morning, right?
Yes.
Magnificent in the morning, right?
Oh, I love it, yeah.
Okay, so I'm on the lake. I look at the sunrise every morning. It's one of the things that I hope differentiates me. A lot of Republicans, the environmental movement has become a little misdirected in terms of not using things. I'm a huge environmentalist, but people have to use it. So I run around this morning and I go, how spectacular is that? how wonderful. And Michigan has that stuff all over the place. And I think we have to promote it. And so you're going to ask, what do you think about Trump and climate change next? You're a reporter. So look, mistake to send money to Shanghai, Peking, Delhi, for them to fix their carbon. We should be using that funds here. We should be building urban parks. We should be fixing our park systems, getting great access. And the people from Saginaw, Detroit, Lansing, they don't need to send their money over to Peking, Guangzhou, for those people to take their jobs. Yeah, there's some stuff we need to do. I think it's not just CO2 or climate warming. There are tons of things. And that one's way overhyped. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say it doesn't exist, because I do think there's some man-made effect, but we're in a global warming cycle. You look at I'm an economist by training. You look at the probability tables, they're not so overwhelming. They're there. They suggest a trend. How much is the natural trend? How much is man-made? That's a little bit more dicey.
Okay.
And spending the dollars that needs to be spent from the treaty, the only party that was going to abide by it was the United States. They were throwing billions already in, and you look in the history of these things, the transfer from developed to undeveloped nations, I think, was misdirected in the treaties. The target for the degree change was misdirected in the treaties. The amount of economic damage from trying to go about it, because it wasn't binding, but if you really tried to hold to what the purpose was devastating. So, I'm absolutely an environmentalist, but I'm on board with Trump on his movement out of the treaty. I think he'll get back in, by the way, but the terms will be different and better for America.
So it really seems like your interest in this is very issue-based. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you have really thought out the issues and where you are. And so since you've kind of gone through this analysis, so What kind of camp do you put yourself in? Are you a conservative, pragmatist,
a penciler camp? Look, I think the labels, everyone that's in the Republican Party loves to say a conservative, right? So it's a nice catchphrase. It's a catchphrase.
Yeah.
Nothing is encompassed by one word, I don't think. Except maybe, and he hates it, individual privacy. Really, individual liberties and freedoms. Sometimes that puts me straight in libertarian camp, and sometimes it puts me crazy, extreme conservative camp, and sometimes it even puts me in liberal camps.
So who did you like in the last presidential primary? Before it became Trump, when we had 18 people, who did you like?
Sure. I worked a little for Rubio.
Okay.
For Marco. And then I actually liked Trump.
Did you really?
Yeah. So I did a little work for Donald.
You what?
I did a little work with Donald back when I was being a financial advisor.
Okay.
Personality-wise, we have severe differences. Policy-wise, I think he's been spectacular. He's not afraid of being a punching bag. And to really do some massive changes, whether you're Reagan, whether you're Margaret Thatcher, and I think whether you're Donald Trump, you have to be willing to go through that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think Marco could have done that. Do I think, I liked his personality better, but issue-wise, I've actually been thrilled with how he's done.
Well, and I asked the question to see if you were going to bite at Rand Paul.
I'm upset.
Upset?
Yeah, I think Rand lets the perfect get in the way of the good a lot. And as a Republican, there's such an incredible opportunity that perspective is really important. So we differ on where we go on health care. We're crazy different on some foreign policy issues. We're different on the Fed. We're different on a whole bunch of policy issues. But fundamentally, we're different is you got to get things done at the end of the day. And one of the other things that I think I'd be differentiated with, aside from the environmental one, which is big, is I want to do stuff for Michigan. And if that means making some trades sometimes that people get upset about, oh well. I want to bring back some stuff to Michigan. I don't think Debbie's done a good job of that. But frankly, I don't think the Senate leadership, or frankly our congressional leadership has done a good job of bringing back things. The Mobility Center for NHTSA. Yeah. The bridge should, Matt, as you saw, I went over and talked to Matt Maroon, who I think is a great guy, but there are a bunch of issues with the bridge that aren't easy. Why aren't we doing public-private partnerships and getting the thing done already? This thing should be built. We need to have that Canadian to U.S. corridor be first rate. And we need rail, too. We need the tunnel being refurbished so you can double stack stuff. If you get the Canadian-U.S. right, you bring in all those German companies that are all around the auto industry. Well, we want this to be a bigger base, not a declining base.
Right.
And not getting on this mobility thing, it could be devastating for Michigan. It's a great opportunity. But if you don't get on it right, it's bad. We're still really heavily dependent there. We've got great engineering. We've got good technology here. We've got to lever that.
How much of your wealth are you willing to spend on this thing? Because that will be a question for sure.
I think it differentiates me again. The Republicans haven't been able to get their message effectively out with Debbie before. She's been spending between 12 and 14 million on her campaigns. And to get our message out, and my message out, we'll have to be spending a lot of money.
Yeah, in the millions.
Many millions. If I'm the candidate, funds won't be the reason why we don't get our message out.
Now, how about in the primary, then?
Funds won't be the reason why I don't get my message out. Doesn't mean that I don't need help. Help does a whole bunch of things. It locks people in, it gets you more excited, and I'd love for it not all to come out of my own pocket.
Right.
So would my kids. but we'll spend what we need to get the message.
Why should people take you seriously?
They'll listen, and hopefully they'll like what they hear.
This is an issue for folks around here. Line 5, should we shut it down?
No.
Why?
Dead set. I think Bill's making an incredibly silly political, and he might be not making a political mistake, but he's making a commercial and an environmental mistake.
Bill Schuette is?
Yes.
Explain why.
Because there's an incredible amount of energy that goes through that pipeline. Pipeline technology has improved incredibly, where you can do checks on the structure of the pipes, you can do flow checks, and you can discover leaks when they're infinitesimal. Do we need an independent third-party testing? You bet. Because once Enbridge didn't disclose everything, they lost a ton of credibility. They do it again, it's a different issue. But we need independent testing, we need strong testing so that this thing never works. But taking that and transferring that energy transfer that people need, we need the what's going through there to light the Lower Peninsula. Is it environmentally bad for all the trucks that have to come over? It's economically bad. And I think it's sort of a false ghost that we're chasing. That's why. I think if it was, a freighter can crash and the probability is 2%, that's crazy. That would be a crazy risk to take. It's not. We can check these pipelines and make sure the robotic underwater treatments that you can do are really good now. The thickness is sufficient that you're, even when they screw up like they did recently, you're not going to have a spill. But yeah, you got to take every precaution not to, but not check.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to our guests for showing up here. And John, it was funny, last Monday when I had the week off, I just happened to be driving by MERS World Headquarters at 10:30, and I saw our lawn crew out there blowing leaves around, and I thought, you know what? I bet you John's trying to do a podcast right now.
That was during the middle of take one of two of our podcast with Stu Sandler, and the podcast went up a lot shorter, because I think by the time we sat down and did it over again, everybody was a lot more succinct and a lot more to the point, and guess what? It was like 3 or 4 minutes shorter than it would have been otherwise.
Yeah. Well, all right. Well, did you move them now to Tuesdays?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, we'll have to deal with that again next spring.
All right. Well, until then, until next week, I'm Kyle Lynn. Have a happy Thanksgiving, everyone, and we'll see you next time.